Welcome to Business Second Opinion. I'm Carol Sanford.
And I'm Zach Swartout.
The purpose of this podcast is to explore designs and practices in business to understand where they are sourced, usually unexamined. In other words, who comes up with these ideas and how do they do that? We also look at their effects, that is, what are they really creating as outcomes and consequences, which is maybe different than what they say or their intentions are. We look at the myths embedded in these practices and what to do instead based on having different sources and different effects that you're pursuing. The next three podcasts we're bringing you, we're going to look more in depth at work design, the future and the past of work design, and how to create a place that serves workers, the work, and the reason for work, which is to be able to serve the marketplace and the stakeholders in it. Carol Sanford Institute has designed and redesigned workplaces and business as a whole for over four decades. We see the world differently, not only from the old traditional organizational theorists, but we see it differently from many of the modern popular psychological ideas.
Do you sometimes feel like work is hell? Or maybe your company has designed work that is great for some and not everyone? Does what you do grow people and the business? Do you have some workers or suppliers who fall short of what you need and others you wish you could duplicate? All of these are factors related to what we call work design. So over the next three podcasts, we're going to do a deep dive into work design. First, we're going to look through the history, which will explain a lot behind what publications like the Harvard Business Review, consultants, and curriculum designers get their ideas, some of them centuries old. Second, we're going to look at the alternatives that people develop to push back and create a different future for business. And third, we're going to look at a set of criteria for understanding human and business growth and how foundational they are to work design and where real success comes from. We call this the regenerative business.
Let's take a stroll through the history of work. It will, I think, create some surprising understandings for you about how we got to where we are today and how you can better understand your own organization and how it got to what it's doing. Consider work design in the United States. It's invisible to most of us, but the entire workplace of today, I'd say close to 99%, is a result of one man's image of work. His name is Frederick Winslow Taylor. He embedded an idea and spread it widely called scientific management, as though science had given him the way for us to do management. It actually included for the first time the ideas that there were managers who were managing other people doing work. When he brought this in, there was really no such idea as manager. There were skilled workers because it had come out of the craftsman era. But Taylor announced that there's no such thing as skilled work. There's only just work. And it pretty much could be automated like the machines they worked on. He recommended four specific guidelines that what he called scientific management came from. First, replace any idea of rule of thumb methods, like kind of estimating how you're doing, based on a scientific study of task. We now know this pretty much as time and motion studies. How fast can you do it and still have no waste? Secondly, he believed that since humans had something above machines, they had to be trained. But you had specifically select the people and train each employee rather than allowing them to train one another or to train themselves. Third, he believed that you needed to provide detailed instructions as well as supervision, that is, somebody who could see over everyone else, the supervision of each worker in the performance of that work's discrete task. And fourth, he believed that you could divide work nearly equally between managers and workers so that the managers applied the scientific principles, in other words, they did the thinking and planning, and the workers actually then performed the task. In other words, please give us no initiative, no personal agency, no thinking. I remember the first time I toured Colgate-Palmolive in Europe. as we were starting that. And I watch people with stopwatches running around the organization. And I asked who these people were and what they were doing. And they said they were efficiency experts. They had been trained to clock people. And what I also noticed as I interviewed and asked people what they thought, they said, "We don't think. We are only allowed to try and beat the time that we have been told is the efficient way to work." Of course, we changed that a few years later, which we'll tell you more about in these podcasts and also in my books.
Taylor gave us the foundation for the standardization of work, but he did not invent it. His source was the founder of what's called averagism. Coming from a wealthy family, Taylor was sent to Prussia to study one of the first countries to organize around the ideas of Adolf Quetelet, who Todd Rose, author of The End of Average, called, quote, "the most impactful scientist on humanity you've never heard of." Todd Rose is also the Harvard School of Education's director for the Center of Mind, Brain, and Education. Quetelet introduced the idea of human averages, eventually coming to the belief that the average was the ideal to be pursued. The average person, he surmised, is a prototype representative of a group. He was the first to introduce the idea of the average man, and we've ever since imaged all members of a group according to a set of shared characteristics that you will hear broadly used to categorize people, such as all lawyers are like this, all Mexicans are like this, all homeless people are like this. And you often hear these used in the business world with buyer demographics and niches. This same thinking has given us personality types. People are categorized into a neurotic type, a leader type, and thousands more. The thinking is, as I'm sure you've guessed already, the source of stereotyping and eventually judging the way workers are by type, like high performing, low performing, etc. In time, Florence Nightingale applied Quetelet's approach to nursing, pronouncing that the average man was actually God's will and people must figure out how to match that. Fearing that England was falling behind during the Industrial Revolution, the ideas of averagism were applied widely to create standards and procedures to better manage productivity. At this point, it's hard to imagine things getting any worse.
But they did get worse. There was a mathematician called Galton who took these concepts and extended them into something called above and below average, and the idea of gifted and useless. It was the beginning of ranking people relative to one another. You might ask at this point, well, what's wrong with that? And part of that is we're so used to it, we can't imagine. That wouldn't happen in school. That's why you have ABCD. That's why you have children who are sent home with report cards and said whether they're above or below average. But as Todd Rose pointed out in his book, The End of Average, and his work at the Institute of Education at Harvard, the idea of average is actually a false premise, and it has been proven so for decades. There is no such thing. Each individual is unique and cannot be compared or ranked. In fact, he goes so far as to say, if you want to understand something, you have to start at the level of the individual, and then you make and build up, but you can't find the average at the beginning. It's all based on what we call a class one error. It means that once you've made that error, the idea that there is something called average, everything after that is false and gets extended to get more inaccurate. In other words, rating and ranking higher and lower. The hardest part of it is it starts to feel correct to us because it has happened so long, it is familiar. We hear it over and over and over again. And we confirm our experience with that bias already built in. Another short story. First time I went to the Bank of Canada, it was a fairly small branch that we started out in. And the president of the bank asked people who were in front of me to introduce themselves. I was nearly knocked backwards on my heels when they introduced themselves based on the personality type they were. I had this experience of this bland boxes of some kind of check mark that everyone had been through until we knew exactly what type they were in. My question to them, is there anyone here which is unique and distinctive, or are you all some box that can be checked? there was a lot of humming and hawing, and they were startled once we started to introduce to them the idea of their own essence, their own uniqueness, and begin to break apart that idea.
I want to remind everyone about how to participate in the show by joining in our quiz on SurveyMonkey each week. This is where you can offer articles for review from HBR or other popular business-written media. Find the link at businesssecondopinion.com. It's more fun to listen when you participate. To get educated about Carol's approach to critiquing popular ideas, you can also download her chapter at businesssecondopinion.com. Plus, there's a weekly drawing for a free copy of Carol's new book, The Regenerative Business. You can qualify for the drawing by participating in the quiz, write comments, or recommend an article for Carol to review.
The next era of work design came from John Watson, who invented the field of behaviorism. You might think of this as one of the great opportunists of the industrial era. As he was having conversations with the industrialists of the time, he noticed that they were very frustrated by the inability to control workers to the same degree they could control machines. They were difficult to standardize, and Watson said it was because they were not machines, but mammal with a set of motivations to consider. For a few million dollars, now in today's money, closer to a billions, he established a laboratory to research the behavioral motivation of rats, thinking he could apply what he learned to the behavior of workers. His hope was to be able to research and tell these industrialists how to manage the motivation of others. This introduced the concept of incentives and rewards you see today, but kept Galton and Quetelet's class one errors of averages, rating and ranking. These are the basis for most programs in business reviews and new program of the month. So you'll see these as employee of the month programs, awards based on exemplary role models that elevate people above all others, or one that's even more common is ranking people through performance reviews. It's hard to imagine any kind of program that we see today that doesn't have this kind of classifying of people. This became the foundation of 20th and 21st century management practice. We keep dragging along Taylor's manager and managing system ideas while giving managers the tools to manipulate people. We also now know that there are class one errors in what Watson added, like that humans are not identical to rats and have so many more abilities. For example, the study of rats leaves out how the executive center of the prefrontal cortex in humans and the ability to engage in alternative interpretations and concepts increase innovation and problem solving in complex situations. Additionally, the behavioral manipulations only work for tasks with short time horizons and low complexity creative tasks. There are hundreds of errors in these two philosophies alone, but we're going to explore a bit more. So to give you an example, there's a recent Fast Company article that reported that the short-sighted solution to improving worker engagement, which is a buzzword that you hear in organizations all the time, has been to focus on making employees happy. Companies started obsessing on the best ways to incentivize employees with perks and benefits and make them really feel good at work. So you see this today often in the rampant competition for all the best places to work awards that I'm sure you see on all the doors of organizations and businesses that you go into. So this is mostly based on how nice it is to work there. The thinking here is that offer them enough incentives and they'll be happy. Unfortunately, studies show extrinsic motivation or giving rewards to drive behavior is actually a terrible motivator. A book by Alfie Cohn called Publishing Punished by Rewards, The Problem with Gold Stars, Incentive Plans, A's, Praise, and Other Bribes, outlines how this focus on extrinsic motivation has actually created the increased dissatisfaction and engagement we are now seeing. People get caught up in getting the reward and often game the system. The more a company tries to bribe their employees into being happy, the less engaged they become. And becoming addicted to praise has been shown to hurt employees' ability to be happy. So all these compliments and rewards programs you're pushing, they're actually working against you as a leader. The good news is, once a company sees the error in their ways, they can follow this process to start to redirect employee engagement methods. In reaction to the outrageous comparison of human to rats, a new philosophy was born. It's often been called the human potential movement. Its premise was that people can grow and change and exercise awareness of and change their opportunities. Focus on the individual became critical, and their personal ability to manage themselves. This was the birth of many alternative work systems and work designs we see today. There are many elements of this movement which are informing these new work designs.
So let me summarize where we are so far. We have been looking at three major approaches a bit briefly on how work design is used. I guess the first one you might call what we now call the traditional one, which draws on the scientific method of Frederick Traylor and the behavioral methods of John Watson and his student B.F. Skinner at Stanford University. These two are behind the predominant approaches today. The second one we might call the modernist movement. It's centered around humans out of the human potential movement. Tavistock and National Training Laboratories were the first ones to really do much of this work. And they created and initiated platforms and processes which the holacracy approach has been extended from. There was a group that split off, which forms our third approach. They split off from what Tavistock was doing and created a very different stream, which has its work and workability based on almost 60 years of multiple generations of practitioners. It was incubated and spread from Procter & Gamble, particularly the soap division in the 1960s. They called it then the developmental approach because it had a different set of beliefs about humans, which is what led to the alternative path from Eric Trist and Fred Amory, who were in Tavistock and who were driving this new human potential movement, where humans were seen as autonomous, seeking, and meaningful work-pursuing beings. Motivation was held to come from job enrichment rather than incentives or external rewards of making something outside better. So let's talk a little more about this third way. It carried forward some of the human potential movement, but it also went in a pretty different direction. So Procter & Gamble's founders did visit Tavistock and looked at what they were doing called the social technical method, which they had brought in from National Training Laboratories in Bethesda, Maryland. That group was experimenting with how can groups work better together? But the team that was leading the Procter & Gamble design on building new business ideas and new work systems for Procter & Gamble chose none of the three before, none of the idea that you should use scientific method, none of the external reward and recognition, and none of the job enrichment ideas. Charles Krohn, who was a chemical engineer, had also studied in a very unorthodox school called the Menager Clinic in Kansas City, Missouri. And it took about 15 of what it could find as the smartest students, and it trained them in a really different way, which was learning to observe their mind and studying with well-known teachers, which were doing development of thinking like Alfred Korzybski in semantics and physicist David Bohm. And they asked them to look at how to learn and how they changed. As a result of this work, Krohn and eventually the others who were working with him saw huge gaps in this socio-technical method and the idea of sensitivity training just to make people aware. They were missing the idea of the development of a person as a whole being. Now, this is very different. Holacracy talks about wholeness and bringing the whole person to the work, but holacracy means fully as they are, accept them as they are. The work that P&G was doing believed that each human being had potential that was undeveloped. And even though there was the human potential word in the movement, it was not really looking at the development of beyond the function or being. This school believed you could develop will and you could help people direct their own will. So he created, or P&G overall created, the foundation of what came to be called then the developmental organization. It engaged each worker directly in a connection to marketplace decisions and in rapid innovation for customers and marketplace change. It positioned Procter & Gamble as the leader in the soap business for P&G, but in the industry. In the 1960s, they moved there and have never been knocked out. They were for decades the most studied work design. Harvard sent folks like Michael Parter or Rosabeth Moss Kanter and Michael Hammer, all because they were amazed at the extraordinary business financial results, and they had no hierarchical power systems. People were being what were then called self-directed. The system has spread over the last five decades by practitioners in system design and by the students of the founders. There are global examples, including the chairman of Shell Oil, Chad Holliday, Will Lynn, who was the president of Kingsford Food and Backyard Barbecue, which included Charcoal and Hidden Valley Ranch and a dozen other brands, Jeffrey Hollander, who was the founder and CEO of Seventh Generation, which is now owned by Unilever. Each of them carried these ideas of the development of people as core, which would lead to very different structures eventually, but there was not much attention paid early. Even the last P&G CEO, A.E. Lafley, acknowledges that the turning point for P&G was this set of developmental systems, and you can read more about that in his Playing to Win book. So what do we know? We've got a lot of people critiquing the modern systems. So, for example, Harvard Business Review has been critiquing recently, as have others like Strategy and Business, all of these different approaches. But they don't actually do a very good job because they're not noticing that what they're critiquing them by are different than the intentions that this new work system is pursuing. For example, there are a lot of analyses of holacracy that have missed the approach that they're taking. In August of 2016, there was an article called Beyond the Holacracy Hype by Ethan Bernstein, John Bunch, Nico Kanner, and Michael Lee. Their assumption is the holacracy is designed to create a balance between reliability and adaptability. That its pursuit, which actually is the pursuit of a traditional system, and so they transfer that over to an alternative system. But if you ask the founders, that's not at all what they had in mind. Holacracy's intention was to work from the human potential paradigm, that second system we talked about, that more modern idea, with the intention of bringing more meaning and personal satisfaction to the workers and into the process of how individuals were able to contribute to the ideals that they were about, including the ideals of the work system. They let them work directly on the improvement of work without the red tape of hierarchy. In fact, the founders say they believe that teams are a better mechanism in decision-making process and even for execution than individuals are when they're managed by others to get their work done. Now, I have several critiques of holacracy myself based on their intentions, which we'll cover more in the next podcast. But you have to start with looking at what a system is pursuing and what paradigm it comes from. And you have to assume that all work systems have different intentions and are designed to better achieve the goals of some system. You can't assume that it's better than to achieve the traditional Taylor methods of efficiency and with a little adaptability. We will look more next time at the developmental approach, but just to give you a taste of what's coming, that developmental approach is a work design not based on traditional management practices, not based on human potential ideals. It's based on a living systems view of all of life, seeing it as alive, seeing it as moving, including business and humans in it. It's designed, and the system has to be designed to ensure disruption because innovation has to be ensured and even required. And it has to benefit more than just the employees. It has to be targeted for more than that. It has to benefit even more than just the business. It has to benefit all the stakeholders to the system. That includes the investors who are in it. And that includes the workers, but it also includes suppliers, the communities they're in. The developmental approach, its intention is to achieve a more direct and distinct benefit for each customer, each co-creator, which includes suppliers and contractors, for Earth as an invested party, and for communities where these businesses sit. And that benefit can achieve more meaning and participative goals of holacracy, but it goes beyond that. So they get meaning and they get to be involved, but it goes way beyond that. They help run the business as a whole, not just work collaboratively in a team. Bureaucracy in both the traditional and human potential design is radically reduced and creates a different kind of focus. But bureaucracy is not the point. What we're working on in a developmental approach is actually creating an innovative, disruptive process which changes the lives and the society we live and the planet we live on. So we'll talk about that more next time.
If you want to learn more, download the free paper on discernment on our website, businesssecondopinion.com. Also, don't forget to visit Business Second Opinion on SurveyMonkey to recommend subjects we tackle in the world of business. Be sure to point to a particular business journal on which you want a business second opinion. Join us next time to look at Holacracy as an example of human potential design and where it's missing some of its own intentions, mixing things up with the machine worldview, and why it has not, and we think, and cannot achieve what the developmental work design can offer. This is Business Second Opinion.